Excellent. An ale for me. And for my officers. In fact, ales for everyone.
Oh. Turn backwards. Rick and work. And Will.
Oh, yes.
Last time on
Turn Backwards.
We are going to handle the topic of war.
Deep Space Nine was the first series where Gene Roddenberry was fully dead.
Hi, Garrett. Punch, punch.
Not really sure why you're listening to this.
It's a fake! It's a fake!
Will's claim here is a fake!
Oh, Garrick, you're not going to kill me today, are you? Wait and see.
I guess because Geordi is a creep.
He is a bit.
And now, the conclusion.
Hello, and welcome to Ten Backwards with myself, Will Turland, this man, Rick Everson.
Hello.
And this other man, Rick Palmer.
Konnichiwa.
We are here to talk about Star Trek. And in particular, we're talking about the Dominion War in Star Trek Deep Space Nine. This wasn't really intended to be a two-part podcast episode, but the previous part, we had so much to say that we've decided to split it into two. And this is part two of the Dominion War.
Where did we leave off?
Well, we discussed the heck out of the siege of AR-558 and In the Pale Moonlight, and we were talking about the morality of war. We talked about how the war started, basically. We talked a little bit about before the war.
We did.
And that takes us to now.
Mm-hmm.
So what shall we talk about next?
I think we should talk about Section 31.
Ooh.
In particular, I know me and Will have both watched
Enter Arma, Aenum Sealant Legis.
My Latin's terrible, so I apologise if I got that horribly wrong. Unless Will has dubbed over a clip from the episode of that being said, in which case, how good was my Dr. Bashir impression?
It's very good.
I know.
I wouldn't dub anything over anyone.
In times of war, the law falls silent.
Yes.
Yeah.
It's a fantastic phrase. Let's just sort of talk through the Section 31 thing first. Mm. They first came to our attention in Series 6 of Deep Space Nine in the episode Inquisition. Bashir is after a medical conference. Why are they letting him do that? Last time he went, he got captured and put in the Dominion prison. Stupid idea.
They love conferences.
There are lots of conferences.
Even
in Voyager, yeah, there are conferences.
They're just flying through the Delta Quadrant and they get invited to flipping conferences.
I was just going to say, didn't Geordi go off to an engineering conference, get kidnapped by the Romulans and turned into a killing machine? I mean, yeah. Did they not? Let's just stop having conferences.
Everyone loves conferences.
In Voyager, Janeway and the Doctor are coming back from a conference and they get captured. And the Doctor has to impersonate lots of members of the Voyager crew.
Oh, yeah. That's a fun episode.
I do like that.
It's enjoyable, isn't it?
Anyway, so the Doctor, Dr. Bashir, is off to this, is going to go to this conference. But, oh no, there's some sort of security breach on the station and everything's locked down. He can't go. There's a special investigation team come in. And these guys are, like, questioning people, but they're quite nice to Bashir. So he's like, oh, they obviously don't think I'm any problem. They're giving me nice scones and jam and things. But, oh, no, they accidentally deliver Worf's gark to him. Anyway, as it turns out, they seem very interested in Bashir. They've got a lot of questions for him. And ultimately, it seems he is the prime suspect. And the guy heading the investigation team, Sloane, he's getting pretty harsh on Bashir. But then Bashir's beamed out by a Dominion ship and Wayne's like, oh, it's you, hi. And Wayne then talks to Bashir like he's a double agent and he's actually working for the Dominion. And they say he's actually compartmentalises his memory and believes that he isn't a traitor until Wayne can sort of break those barriers down and they'll start then giving him all the information. Well, this is just a bit weird. And then the Defiant chases the Dominion ship down and gets Bashir out. Everyone's mad at Bashir because he's like a traitor. And then he realises Chief O'Brien's arm doesn't hurt when it should because he treated him for a shoulder twist from a kayaking injury.
Huh?
Oh, that again.
Where was he kayaking? On the holodeck, of course, the holodeck.
Like they're on now. This has all been on the holodeck.
What?
And actually, Sloane represents an organisation called Section 31, and they want to check that Bashir's on the level and recruit him.
Did you say an organisation? I think you maybe meant an organisation.
Now, in the future, it's called an organisation.
We've got too much to talk about to sorry, use four words.
This is a band in the future.
I don't mean to be a pedant, but I just love the English language. Sorry, man, I've killed your flow. I'm very sorry.
It's a good episode. It raises a lot of interesting questions, like why did the Jem'Hadar leave that runabout around their prison asteroid so the guys could all use it to escape? Mm. And it doesn't answer that question, annoyingly, but everyone assumes it's okay. So, but then we get the rather troubling issue that there's this organisation in Starfleet that are prepared to do some pretty dodgy dealings, pretty dark stuff. It's like, and they want to recruit Bashir. So it's like, wow, that's a bit of a departure from the normal stuff. So
is this the CIA?
Yeah,
essentially.
It's an interesting concept. I think it's captured a lot of people's imagination. So, and then we don't hear much from that for a while until Series 7.
Enter Arma, Einem Sealant Legis.
Where Bashir is off to. He's off to a conference. It's on Romulus.
Yeah.
But Sloane appears in his room. Creepy. Yeah, watching him sleep for a bit. In fact, how long had Bashir been asleep before he realised Sloane was there? Could have been hours.
With his cherished teddy bear, Kukulaka.
and his high collar blue silk pyjamas.
Yeah, I can't sleep. You can't sleep with a high collar. It's too.
Bashir does, but do you know what? It'll be because of his genetic engineering.
Ah, yes.
this is a fantastic episode. Basically. They recruit Bashir attempt to recruit him to go to Romulus and gather some information. Particularly, they want to know about their new head of the Tal Shiar, called Kaval. Actually, interestingly, was also the same actor who played the Romulan charge of brainwashing Geordi into being a killing machine in that Next Gen episode just talked about. Yeah, turns up when you go to conferences.
Yeah, you could almost believe that character's the same. That character's the same.
That would have been interesting, actually.
But do we know the name of the character that brainwashes Geordi?
I don't know. Maybe that's something we could look up.
Maybe it is. Yeah. I might do that.
Yeah, I think you should.
I will.
He also plays Silic on Enterprise.
Ah, cool.
Yes, it's that guy. So Bashir goes to Admiral Ross, who's also on this conference mission and seems like he's cool, he's on his side, he's saying, you're right, okay, go along with what he wants for the moment, we'll find a good time to expose him. And it turns out Sloane is encouraging Bashir to find a way to determine if Kaval is suffering from an illness, and then if, as it turns out he is, he's saying, oh, how can we accelerate that illness? So it looks like it's an assassination plot. So Bashir's going to go talk to Admiral Ross. Oh no, Admiral Ross has had an aneurysm and is incapacitated in sickbay.
How convenient.
It is a bit convenient. Admiral Strangely, Ross. Bashir doesn't go to sickbay and try and treat him.
Mm.
In fact, he says, who can I talk to? Can't trust anyone on the ship. The Romulan senator who's been based at Deep Space Nine for a while. I like her. So he talks to her, tells her the crazy stuff, and she agrees to help him and tries to infiltrate Romulan records on Kaval. He's caught. Kaval takes Bashir off to the side, uses Romulan mind probes on him, but they're no use because he's genetically engineered. The eternal excuse for anything. And so ultimately, Kaval, Bashir, and Senator Kreetak are all there in front of the Romulan Continuing Committee, faced by Praetor Nerral. Nerral being the guy who was actually in Unification in TNG. Two-parter. Different actor, but...
Same character.
Supposed to be the same guy.
Yeah, of course.
But he looks like the demands of office have aged him. So Bashir explains his story, and then Kaval says, there's a bit more to this, and he drags in a beaten-up Sloane. and says that Sloane is in fact a guy from Starfleet Intelligence who's gone rogue, made up a fictional Section 31, and wants to do it to avenge the death of his mentor.
And at this point in the episode, because I'd actually not seen this episode before, I realised, but before until I watched. Yeah, Rick's looking at me incredulous.
I am incredulous, because I seem to recall I watched most of Series 7 with you. We shared a house at the time.
Oh, yeah. Wait, you didn't watch this one with me, unless I've flushed it out of my brain.
Maybe you've had your mind altered.
Oh, maybe. Yeah. But I just didn't recall this episode at all. And at this point, I thought, oh, is that how the whole Section 31 thing is resolved then? Does it turn out it was just Sloane, nutty old Sloane, inventing it all in his crazy old brainium? But no, please continue, Rick, because that is not the end of the story.
Yes, it is not. So Sloane, angered at being exposed, goes crazy and tries to attack Kaval, and Kaval shoots him, disintegrates him with a disruptor. Uh-oh, that's the end of Sloane.
Yeah, that's that resolved.
The Romulans say they're going to have to punish Senator Kreatak for being so daft and send Bashir on his merry way.
Yeah. You are very daft.
He's silly, silly. Senator Kreatak. You're in a lot of trouble.
5 years in prison for being daft.
Yeah.
Bashir returns to the Bellerophon, the ship that's bought them there. And, oh, Admiral Ross is all better again.
What?
Just recovered. So he goes and sees him and says, oh, nice to see you're all better. And then he says, he asks him a very pointed question.
Where's Sloane?
Admiral Ross doesn't say, Sloane, your report said he was dead. He says,
if we're going to have this discussion, then it's off the record.
He takes off his comm badge. And it turns out, Admiral Ross has been working with Sloane. Sloane is not dead. That disruptor was merely made to look like it disintegrated him, actually beamed him to safety. So it looks like Sloane's out of the picture. Kaval's now elevated to the continuing committee. Kreatak's disgraced as his main rival for this position of power. And Kaval is in fact a double agent working for the Federation.
What? I have to say, I wasn't totally convinced by the... because I think Admiral Ross says the idea was that that Sloane is beamed away the instant before the disruptor blast hits him, but they aren't sure whether that's worked or not.
No.
Well, in that the
like
effect,
technology that really needs to work.
But the effect looks like he is disintegrated. Does not look like a transporter effect. We know what a transporter effect looks like. I don't know.
They did the same thing in Gambit, didn't they? That was the thing that he thought Picard had been disintegrated in a bar fight, but it turned out he'd been beamed to the ship.
Yeah, it's an old trick.
Also, if you're going to create a technology that makes someone look like they've been disintegrated, it's not going to look like they've been beamed out.
Yeah, no, fair enough. Maybe
to make
it was
a non-standard transporter beam effect.
Fair enough. Point conceded.
So yes, the basic thrust of the argument comes through, like how. Bashir says, how can you work with Section 31, Admiral Ross? And his response is, in time of war, the law falls silent. Section 31 are working to make sure the Federation win. And we're back to the same issue as Sisko. It's like, how far can your morals be pushed? And Section 31 have no morals. They're willing to preserve the Federation at any cost. And in fact, their justification is they do it so people with morals, like Bashir, don't have to. Although that seems a bit weird because they're trying to recruit Bashir. So.
But at the very end of the episode, Sloane shows up again, creepily, in Bashir's bedroom. And he said, I was just searching so I could recall this line, because he has a really good line which kind of explains his position, where he says,
Federation needs men like you, Doctor. Men of conscience, men of principle. Men who can sleep at night. You're also the reason Section 31 exists. Someone has to protect men like you from a universe that doesn't share your sense of right and wrong.
So that's Sloane's justification for Section 31. It's a cool line. It's a succinct paragraph that sums up why Section 31 exists. And I really like it. He kind of sells Section 31 pretty well in that line, I think. Mm. He's kind of got a point.
It's ironic as well, because Bashir loves being a playing at being a spy.
Yeah.
When it comes to the nitty gritty.
Yeah. Well, one thing I thought about this episode is that who's the actor who plays Bashir?
Alexander Siddig.
Yeah, that's it. He didn't think he quite nailed the scenes at the end where he kind of has to have some exasperated conversations with Admiral Ross. And he has to do a little bit of shouting. He doesn't quite nail it, I don't think.
Mm-hmm.
Where Avery Brooks would be on the edge.
I know what you mean. In the Pale Moonlight, where he lodges his complaint against Sisko, he also, I don't feel he nails that.
No, I agree with that. Maybe Alexander Siddig just doesn't do rage well. Maybe he's just a very calm man.
And no, we're never going to get an interview with him on the podcast.
Now that we've done it, we've questioned his
ability to rage.
We'd be the guys that could turn that around. Could make him very angry.
I'm sure we could. Yeah. Give me 5 minutes with him, I'd make him furious.
Apologies, Alexander Siddig. But it's a cool episode.
I have just looked it up, by the way, and in the LaForge episode we're referencing, the Romulan officer's name is Tabak. And not Kaval.
Okay.
So they are different people.
I know I said I'd look that up, but what I did was totally looked up something else. I didn't have any intention of looking.
No, I knew.
Had my own. Yeah, it's good that you
had your own agenda.
Yeah, it's
like
good.
Section 31. You were doing the job that I couldn't.
That's disinformation.
It's good that you picked up on that, though. You knew that I wasn't reliably going to do this thing I said I was going to do.
So what we've really hit upon is that Deep Space Nine portrays war as something that will push men to the boundaries of their...
Yeah.
The limits of what their moral code allows.
And I think it also portrays the Federation in a slightly different light. And maybe a more, slightly more realistic light that it's...
Is it saying that the Federation can't exist without that seedy underbelly that protects people without their knowledge? That does those things that shouldn't be done, but have to be done?
I don't know if it's saying that it can't exist without that. It's just saying that is...
But Enterprise established that Section 31 existed before the Federation,
no,
right?
They were a human organisation originally, yeah.
So.
But then you think the Romulans got the Tal Shiar, the Cardassians had Obsidian Order. So actually, if we've got Section 31, does that just leave the Klingons as the guys who are the most upfront, you know, straightforward, this is what we are, guys?
As far as we know.
Well, actually, yeah. They are the best at secret organisations because we haven't found theirs yet. Or, you know, they are just like, let's have a war knock and punch each other in the face, and that is it for the Klingons.
Yeah.
You know, well,
like, maybe like Rick said, it's an honour thing. It's dishonourable.
I would imagine so. I hugely think that. But then, actually, Klingon society wavers in its honourableness. Mm. You know, we look at, as Ezri says to Worf, when is the last time that we had a leader of the Klingon High Council you actually respected?
Mm.
Yeah. They say honour, but do they actually stick to it? And we did see they didn't. Before, if you look previous to Gowron, there was a guy who was willing to let Worf's family take a dishonour that wasn't theirs to protect a family that was dishonourable just because they were influential and powerful.
Yeah.
This is not good. Yeah. Gowron seemed like an okay guy initially, but, you know, he had his own issues. So.
Yeah,
slightly off topic now from the war. But
yeah.
Although, you know, Gowron's issues were actually quite relevant to the war because he found he couldn't tolerate Martok being the hero of the war and had to sabotage the Klingons' efforts, ultimately leading to Worf challenging him and killing him.
Yeah, smashes him through a big old glass window thing, I seem to recall.
Yeah, it was pretty sweet.
Speaking of war. How do you think the characters change throughout the war? I think we've already talked about Sisko changing from the beginning of DS9 to the end, and I think the war definitely shapes him as a character.
It does. Although he's also shaped by the Bajoran prophets, I think.
Yeah.
The exposure to that religion, that has a massive effect. I don't know if the war influences him as much as other events, because Sisko's had war before.
Mm.
It's said he was in the Zenkithi War, and he's more likely involved with the Cardassian War.
Mm.
In the same way, I think O'Brien was not particularly affected by the war, having already been through a Cardassian War.
Yeah, and Sisko fought in the Zenkithi War with Admiral Layton.
He did.
On the
Okinawa,
yeah.
Mm. I think we've got other characters like Bashir, massively
affected.
You know, when you look at how Bashir was at the beginning of Deep Space Nine, and he was always intended to be this annoying character who grew into someone mature and likable.
Mm.
It worked. It's a fantastic arc. Beautifully done.
I wonder if that arc always would have been there with or without the war. I don't know, but it does feel like the story. I feel
Bashir became more cynical and embittered at points in the war, and it was only O'Brien and his relationship with Ezri that sort of kept him from really going darker in a way.
Yeah.
Did Nog join Starfleet when the war was going on? Or?
Nog joined because he left for Starfleet Academy early series 4.
Okay.
So, but obviously it changed Nog.
Season 3, isn't it?
Because he's down a leg.
Yeah.
So. Yeah, yeah,
and that's a huge thing. The whole Only a Paper Moon episode where he had to come to terms with that and couldn't, and he was like hiding out on the holodeck for ages.
Dick Fontaine's really changed by the war, because he exists.
Yes, yeah.
But it's nice that they actually. I mean, that's a great thing that DS9 was able to do, to follow up big events that happened for characters with an episode.
Odo was hugely impacted by it all, because he's got this level of guilt that his own people are behind it. Then he's got this whole confusion that he wants to go to his own people, and I think he feels guilt for that because they're against, his people work against his moral code. And then he's got that whole like, I feel like I belong with the solids, but I also feel like the outsider in the solids. And there's a very, Odo runs a huge, complex range of stuff.
Yeah,
I think throughout that,
there's the whole season where he is a solid as well, isn't there?
Mm. Yeah, when he's turned. Yeah, so that gives him a whole new level of it. And then, of course, there's the war arc where when him and the female change, he basically forgets everything else and he's just so
becomes
up
a
in that.
Big solid during that.
Yeah.
Can't deny it, because there is a point that said, oh, that's how the solids experience intimacy. And they both kind of seem a little bit awkward and embarrassed by it.
Yeah.
It's like...
She is great, especially when she gets all flaky in season 7. Yeah. Ooh, yikes.
Odo's got a pretty
I'd say Kira doesn't, because Kira is a character who is already affected by war. Massively. I think
she's warmer by the end. Yes. Weirdly. Her change goes either way, I think. She's very angry at the beginning, and by the end she's more compassionate. Because she's fighting with Cardassians by the end of it. In season 7 she's fighting with Damar.
Well, I mean, Kira's arc is fantastic, because I think it's towards the end of the first series where we have Duet.
I was gonna mention Duet earlier on.
Really, when Kira realizes that Cardassians are people,
mm.
and they're not just all evil monsters.
Mm. Yeah, helping Cardassians be a resistance.
This is a recurring theme. We have like Second Skin, where she's made to look Cardassian and used in a plot to expose this T'Keni Gamorre as traitorous by having Kira forced to pose as his daughter. I mean, it's a very confusing thing for Kira, but she forms a relationship, and in series 5 that pays off when he comes to her as he's going to die.
So, yeah, it is really good. It's very
so she comes to have a completely different understanding and relationship with Cardassians. Damar's a tricky one, because he did kill Zial, and she looked after Zial. She had this very caring relationship with her, and so there is that thing, but she's still prepared to go out and help Cardassians fight against Dominion. The only one that
as well becomes a hero.
Like, he does. Complete art. He goes from like cocky sidekick of Descartes to sudden surprise leader of the Cardassians, to like, I'm basically a puppet leader for an oppressed people, to freedom fighters. A hell of a range for Damar. that he goes through.
He's arguably very much a secondary character. So for a secondary character to get such an in-depth arc is
great. Deep Space Nine is great that way.
Yeah, look at Nog. Agree.
Look at Nog, very much a background, you know, recurring character at best. Gets a whole episode after his leg's blown off.
Yeah.
Apparently writing staff afterwards, they were writing that, and Ira Stephen Baer was going around saying, if I'd known we were going to do this episode, I'd have blown O'Brien's leg off. Oh, poor O'Brien. O'Brien's not changed by the war because he's had so much shit dumped on him continually since the start-up.
Leg. Not least of all his marriage. I mean, he's already got that to cope with. War's nothing.
His wife's Japanese, though. I think she's probably pretty, she's pretty imaginative in the bedroom.
Oh my goodness. I don't want to imagine anything about O'Brien's. That's for the O'Briens to know and us to think about something else like war.
Because she's Japanese.
I'm also slightly concerned about this weird racial stereotype is dreamed
up. Well, if Japanese animation and like ancient woodcuts are anything to go by, Japanese women are, they're very imaginative.
Keiko O'Brien is a person in their own right and not beholden to any woodcuts or anime that may have existed in the past.
What I would say about O'Brien and Keiko's relationship is that, it's kind of realistic. Like we see them having relationship problems, and we see them clashing with each other. And although I know we're always joking about Keiko being awful, but.
Yeah, she's okay.
It's a realistic relationship. It's more realistic than some of the other.
She gives him a pretty long leash. He hangs out with Bashir a lot.
Yeah, he does. Building models.
For a while, she essentially moves down to Bajor for a while.
Yeah.
And he's just chilling out.
He's got his bro pad.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. I kind of like all that stuff. And
I'm a massive fan of the O'Brien Bashir bromance. It's one of the best elements of DS9 to me, because it's very, very human, very, very fun, very. And it's good relief to the dramatic moments as well. Yeah.
And any time where Worf pours scorn on it is always hilarious.
Absolutely. It's one of the best double acts, is that bromance and Worf.
Yeah.
So, and that's, you know, when we get to the finale of Deep Space Nine. And we have that. Oh, honestly, it breaks my heart every time I watch it. But everyone's leaving, and you have the little the soft tinkling music and all the black and white montages of stuff. And honestly, that damn O'Brien Bashir bromance montage kills me every time.
Yeah,
I bet someone's put it on YouTube.
He'll be crashing on their couch at Starfleet, wherever they are on Earth. After his latest romantic thing has gone wrong, he's got his latest holodeck program to play.
Who are we talking about?
Bashir, when he goes to visit the O'Briens on Earth after Deep Space.
His latest romance would be with Ezri.
But that didn't work out, right?
No, it totally didn't work out because Ezri marries me. So
I don't think that's canon, Rick.
Headcanon. It's my headcanon.
I don't want to know too much about you.
I'm not saying I've written fan fiction, but there's about 4,000 pages. No, I'm joking. I'm not joking.
He isn't joking.
Wait, are we still talking about war?
Yeah, I think we were.
As General Martok says, there's a whole other battleground in the domestic household of man marriage, isn't it? So,
the war of the bedroom.
I don't think it says bedroom.
No, I don't know if Klingons would do it in the bedroom.
Just Klingons totally do it in the bedroom.
They do it all over the place. Anyway,
help us out here.
We're in a position now where things are rapidly deteriorating thanks to beer and.
Let's try and pull it back to war and Deep Space Nine. How satisfying do you think the war story arc was in DS9 in terms of what it explored? And
extremely, because I think it explored many facets. It was fascinating to see the characters go through points where they had to be pushed beyond the boundary of their moral code. I think Next Generation was very, very tidy and neat in the way that things went, that the characters very rarely got their hands dirty in that way. They were always able to have this position of the moral high ground. And in Deep Space Nine, we pushed them beyond that.
Mm.
It wasn't always that easy. It wasn't that straightforward. And we had to push our characters beyond that comfort level. And we had to make Sisko really go beyond an area he was comfortable with and bring the Romulans in.
Mm.
We had to make Bashir... I don't know. Sometimes the Bashir episodes came off that he still maintained that. And it was... I think maybe Admiral Ross bore the brunt of that moral compromise. I think it was intended that Bashir would have been, and never quite got there. But then actually, the final one, Bashir pulls out some Romulan mind probes to use on Sloan. Effectively kills him, because Sloan does kill himself to escape giving up the information.
Mm.
So it's like kind of like you have directly used an illegal item to set in course some events that lead to this guy's death. So, you know, but...
Deep Space Nine was the perfect kind of series for to have a war story, I think.
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah, because going on what we've said, war is something that you know, few people have to engage in directly, but it can affect everyone, and everyone has an opinion on it. And ultimately, if you are involved in it, it's as much being dealing with the horror of it as understanding how it changes you and what you end up being comfortable with.
I think
if you come from a position where you're a moral person, you think you have an understanding of right and wrong. What war does is challenge that.
Mm.
It makes you realise what you're willing to do.
Mm.
And no one can know that until they do it.
Yeah.
When you're not in a war, you feel like you have an understanding of what you can do. And what war does is it makes things uncertain. It makes you unable to really know exactly what your potential is.
I think we...
Yeah.
DS9 just showed it beautifully, because it dedicated a whole episode to Nog coming to terms with an injury. We had Field of Fire, where we had an excellent episode where Ezri has to use Jiran to track down a killer. It turns out it's a Vulcan who's literally snapped under the stuff he's seen in the war. He's like lost his entire crew. It's the ship he was on, everyone died except him. So he's got PTSD, he's got survivor's guilt. And he just develops this fixation on people laughing. He starts shooting people dead when they have a picture of laughter in their quarters or something like that. It's like, when we're at the point where we're actually breaking Vulcan's minds with this war, that's pretty damn serious.
Mm.
And I think Deep Space Nine was a great series to do it, because like we said, a Next Generation, because it was episodic in nature, it was harder to deal with the consequences of things that happened in the episode. Whereas in Deep Space Nine, it was all about the consequences. We'd have an episode of something which would have a massive impact going forward. And really, a key episode was maybe Call to Arms, which is the season 5 finale, where the Federation lose Deep Space Nine. It's attacked by the Dominion Cardassian Alliance.
That tough decision that this war has got to happen now, because we're at this point where we've got to stop the Dominion keep coming through, otherwise the eventual obvious war that will happen is not going to be winnable. So we have to mine the wormhole now, where at a point where we can still take them on.
Yeah, which will push them into full scale war.
It does push to the war, but better push the war now before they've got too many ships and people. So I can sort of see that. But also doing it now, we have not got the resources to start this war, have this blow dealt, and keep Deep Space Nine.
Mm.
And so it just becomes a series of difficult decisions for the next 2 years.
And what a great way to end a cliffhanger series where you've lost the station. And then the next 6 episodes of season 6 deal with building up to, well, just to taking it back.
Literally a continual arc, which is unheard of for Star Trek. We've had three parties on Deep Space Nine, and DS9 keeps its continuity close, much closer than any other series had to that point. But to just do 6 connected episodes straight off like that was a bold move. It paid off so beautifully that obviously they ended up saying, let's do 10 for the finale.
Yeah.
You see massive fleets as well.
That's it, and that's something we've never seen. And we've not really seen that since in Star Trek either. No. Like, even in Enterprise, when they did the Zindia, we didn't really see fleets like we see in DS9.
No. What I liked about Call to Arms is they go and join this fleet, and everyone's like, oh, that's it, now we're going to go back and kick some Dominion ass. And they immediately open Series 6 with that fleet having been smashed the hell in.
Yeah.
And it's like, whoa, dear, that didn't work then. And actually, for 98% of their next 2 years, the Federation is having its ass whooped.
Yeah.
It's not winning. This is not a foregone conclusion by any stretch. So it's very grim. When you think about a lot of Next Gen episodes, you know, they avoid battles and use negotiation, but always so often the Enterprise is in the position of strength.
Yeah.
They're like, oh, yeah, these guys are going, I think they've got, like, their weapons have never hurt us, and stuff like that. So it's like, well, then it's easy to negotiate a settlement from there, isn't it?
Yeah.
Yeah, Picard's actually... Is he that great a diplomat, or is he just like everyone should listen to him? Because his ship will blow up your planet.
That's it. He's sat on the biggest gun in the fleet.
Yeah. When I say Theodore Roosevelt, one of his most famous things was "Speak softly and carry a big stick."
Yeah, and the Galaxy class starship was a very big stick to carry. So. However, a dilapidated Cardassian station, not so much.
Yeah,
it's almost all the more galling that the Enterprise D goes out with a whimper. Star Trek Generations.
Had to
have issues about one old geriatric bird of prey taking it down like that. Yeah. Maybe one day we'll do a podcast about Generations.
Yeah. What I might do is edit all of the points where we've talked about Generations into one. A clip show, and there we go.
You're going to take out all the bits where we say one day we'll do a podcast on this, and we'll just make ourselves a voice list.
I might do
so
that.
Overall, I think Star Trek depicts war pretty much always interestingly, but maybe only really with DS9 where they were able to kind of they had the time to really go into it,
and show the repercussions
and kind of explore how war affects people, how it affects people and how it makes people, feel about themselves and what they would be willing to do.
What do you think of the finale and the way the war finally came to its conclusion?
I think it was logical because the female founder had already stated that she would give up the entire Alpha Quadrant to get Odo back. So it's completely logical that at that worst point Odo would come to her and say, I will come back to the Great Link, but we need to end this war and you need to give yourself up as a war criminal. I will go back to the Great Link. Not only will I rejoin the Link, I'll cure them of the disease. Just kind of another pot to sweeten the deal.
And Odo, Odo going back, kind of probably, you get the sense that it would help the Great Link understand solids better.
Yeah, he's got a mission there now. Is to take everything he's learned about them, and you do see Odo's clear thing from like very standoffish, brusque, grumpy, in this first series to like in Series 7 when Lars arrives. We have this thing and he tries to integrate Lars into his social group and you realise then it's been so subtly done, but actually Odo's now, he's made friends, he has relationships, he has a family there. And I think that's an important thing, and then for him to go back and communicate those to the Great Link are the things that's going to help maintain any sort of peace and really get the Dominion into a different mindset. I think that's what Odo's mission is there. And it's also a completion of his arc, because it's always been about him and his identity, initially finding out who he was, who he's from, and then reconciling that. When he finds out, reconciling who he is with where he's come from.
It felt inevitable that he was going to return to the Great Link.
And because then they can add in the emotional pathos of the fact that he's had this relationship with Kira for a year and a half now. So.
Yeah.
So with the do you think the Jemadar and the Vorta would be freed from their genetic devotion to the Founders? Or?
We don't know. I mean, if you look at the books, the follow-on novels, Odo deliberately sought out Jemadar, who did not have a reliance on Ketracel White. That's been established, I think, in Series 4. There was the occasional aberration, they didn't need the one. So he'd sought that there, and he sent one to go live on Deep Space Nine to sort of get more understanding of humanity. So he did look to free the Jemadar. I mean, how you'd go about it, I don't know. In a way, I can see the logic of maintaining the Jemadar as a general peacekeeping force in the Dominion, but you don't want to, you want to scale it back from like elaborate make war on everyone force. The Vorta,
I guess maybe the
Vorta you want to keep on in an administrative role anyway, because they were doing that job and doing it well. But it's that thing of like, how can the Jem'Hadar reproduce naturally? Probably not.
But maybe they can produce Ketracel White, but it's been switched off, so. Mm. Maybe they can reproduce, but they just don't have that.
Well, I don't think they've bred any Jem'Hadar women.
Are there any women?
Yeah.
No, I don't think so.
It's big changes. What he does, I don't know. But his initial thing is the whole philosophical outlook of the Dominion. Yeah.
And the Cardassian forces kind of rising up and rebelling against the Dominion. That works pretty well.
Yeah.
I think that one problem is it felt like it was a foregone conclusion by the time the finale came up. We'd had a sort of a preamble to the Cardassians rising up against the Dominion.
Yeah, and getting commands to do stuff is very smooth. Like the Cardassians are fighting on our side all of a sudden.
Yeah,
it's a very kind of neat.
There wasn't anything that especially. Then surprising in the finale. I think everything built to a logical conclusion.
I also felt it was a bit faceless. All of a sudden these Cardassian ships are firing on Dominion ships. It would have been great if we'd seen a couple of scenes on the bridge of one of those Cardassian ships of like a couple of the crew turning on the captain saying, this is our time, this is where we turn on the Dominion. This is what's happened. Lakarian city's been destroyed.
Yeah.
I'm arguing with the captain. And then the captain sits back and he's going to make this decision. You don't know how it's going to go. And it's a busy episode.
Yeah.
You couldn't have crammed that in. But it just suddenly felt like, all of a sudden, boom, look, they're all suddenly attacking.
Just very neat.
Yeah. You understand the logic and the why, but I just feel like in the terms of the drama in the moment, it would have been a thing you could have had.
In terms of a final episode, it doesn't really like it leaves a lot of things open.
Yeah.
Sisko is with the prophets and all these other characters are going off and doing stuff. But
it gives
it gives everyone a path, but it's not a very final episode, I would say.
But in a way, that sort of works, because I guess
I don't mind that. I mean,
it feels like, you know, like real life in a way that life is going to go on outside of that episode, and I quite like that.
Yeah, and if they ever do another Star Trek series set after that, they got a lot of potential to go back to.
Yeah,
I hope they'd follow it up in some way, just to see Sisko come back.
That'd be great.
He's got a child there.
Yeah.
I can't see Sisko being happy with leaving that child.
Mm.
So
it's a minor point, but one thing that really annoys me about that season finale is how they reuse all the effects. So they in the big final battle, I think there's one new effect shot where the Defiant does a kind of a loop the loop and takes out some Jem'Hadar ships. Really cool effect shot. That's the only new effect shot in the entire final battle. The rest of it is reused from other episodes. Oh, what a jip. Like, come on. Come on, spend some money. Give us a few new explosions at least. But, you know, it's the battle almost at that point is... It's kind of redundant. It's a foregone conclusion, and the story.
The big story is going to be the resolving of Sisko and Descartes.
Yeah,
that's essentially why we're all here now. We know the war's going to get tied up.
Yeah, and we basically know how it's going to go. We know that
because it's beyond the war now. Sisko and Descartes, the prophets and the power wraiths. Very, very slowly and sneakily, that religious Bajoran religion thing that was introduced at the beginning and everyone thought would fade into the background had come, just kept now and again just putting these little bits out, and all of a sudden it was the priority.
Yeah,
and that's really clever and really sneaky the way that was, because to be honest it was not an interesting storyline at the beginning. But they recognised that and they said, okay, we're not going to focus on that now and again, we'll throw a little one in and just enough to intrigue you, to bring you in, and suddenly by the Series 7 you're just like, oh, you know, Sisko was like actually created by a prophet, and you realise how much it's drawn you in, and it becomes this priority thing by the end. It's like, that's really well done, sneaky buggers.
That's what, and outside of the war discussion, like DS9 maybe is the series that goes the most supernatural in a way, and the most sort of spiritual, especially with the power wraiths and the prophets.
Well, what's nice is that they can very early on they're classified as just very advanced beings, but the way they have set themselves up and the way the Bajorans are, you can do both.
Yeah.
So you can have that spirituality and you can explore that and you can explore religion, but you can also fall back on the thing was that, well, they are just actually really advanced aliens, but you know, who are we to tell the Bajorans that they can't believe what they believe?
Yeah.
And that's what works really nicely.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, it feels like we've come to the end of our pretty epic discussion on war.
Yeah.
We've
had a pretty war-heavy evening.
We really have.
Yeah.
Thanks for staying with us, listeners.
Yes.
Hopefully talk about something a little lighter.
Four episodes?
Yeah.
So two-parters.
Probably about 2 days of our real lives. Yeah, I think next time we should pick some topics that are a little smaller in scope.
But best pets in Star Trek.
I like it. Yeah. Most fun haircuts.
Okay.
In Voyager.
Okay.
The doctors.
Do you prefer for Janeway with her hair down or in the bun?
Ooh, I think down.
I think I prefer bun.
But what? Tune in next time. Will and Rick go head to head on hairdos. we're not going to do that. It's been great. I think we've really discussed the heck out of war in Star Trek.
I think we have.
Been fun. Enjoyed
definitely.
It.
Thank you so much for listening. We'll be back with another episode very soon.
Yeah.
Until then, take care of yourselves.
Don't declare war on each other. And
or if you do, do it fairly.
Yeah.
Along the agreed convention.
Check your morals.
Yeah, don't compromise your morals in the course of that war.
And good night.
Stay safe.
Bye.
Let's make sure history never forgets the name.
Ten Backward.
Buddy, don't you think you should rephrase that?
Ten Backward. Ten Backward.
That's a glib answer and a cheap way to avoid the fact that you've trampled on the very thing that those young men and women are out there dying to protect. Does that not mean anything to you?